The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And today, one of my oldest friends in the wrestling business, he also happens to be the co-host of Kill in the Town, the podcast with Cyrus. He's replacing Lance Storm. Paul Lazenby is here on Talk is Jericho. You heard him on Keep It 100. You heard him on Steve Austin's podcast. Paul was a professional wrestler. I helped train him. He fought in MMA. He worked as a Hollywood stuntman. He was Steve Austin's double. Also, as a bouncer. He's got a bunch of stories about all of that. He's collected a bunch of stories for two books of his When We Were Bouncers tomes, talking about a bunch of famous people that used to be bouncers, like myself. He's got a bunch of cool stories about all the guys in his books. He's got stories about what it was like as working Steve Austin's stunt double, what that was like, how he got into stunt work and acting in the first place. He also trained at the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling School in Calgary, where he met Lance Storm, who was the head trainer. You can hear about Paul's favorite and not so favorite matches from his time in wrestling and a couple of his early gimmicks, Death Wolf Pheasant. That was a good one. Paul fought for Pancras in Japan when he was in MMA. He's got other great stories about living and fighting in Japan. He's also talking about his books, When We Were Bouncers, and some of the celebrities who shared stories about their bouncing days. Paul Lazenby's coming up. But so is Fozzie. We're hitting the road again very soon on the Judas Rising Tour. Continues again in July. A bunch of festival dates. July 12th, Rock USA in Oshkosh. 13th is the Cadot Rock Fest in Wisconsin. Peoria on the 14th. And Belvedere at the Apollo Theater on July 15th. Then we head all the way over the pond to Europe. We start off on the 26th at the Pheasant Festival in Hungary. We go through Prague, Germany, Switzerland, Serbia, Italy, Slovenia. Wacken, the big Wacken Festival, will be there on August 3rd. Berlin, Bochum, Aschaffenburg, Spain, Belgium, and we end off at the Bloodstock Festival in England, in Derbyshire, in England, on August 12th. And then the Judas Rising Tour starts again in the United States with Adelita's Way and Stone Broken and The Stir, Friday, August 24th. We kick that off in Atlanta at Smith's Old Bar. We go to Huntsville, Clarksville, Little Rock, Joliet, Illinois, Omaha, Nebraska, Des Moines, Minneapolis, Fargo, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Columbus, Ohio, Cincinnati, Louisville, Charlotte, Jacksonville, North Carolina, Huntington, Greenville, Savannah, Orlando, Florida, House of Blues, Tampa at the Orpheum, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Jacksonville, Florida, all those dates and VIP information, FozzyRock.com. Go check it out. Best VIP in the business. We play a mini set for you guys. We meet you. We greet you. We take pictures. We do all the stuff that we got to do. Go to FozzyRock.com and find all the dates and VIP info and ticket information. Great summer of rock with Fozzy and a great summer of awesome Talk is Jericho episodes starting now with Famous Bouncers with Paul Lazenby. All right. So it's funny. Sometimes you see somebody that you haven't seen for a while. I'm here with Paul Lazenby, and you're like one of the oldest friends that I have in the business. It's crazy.
That's insane, man. It's over a quarter century that I've known you, man.
Yeah.
It's funny when you're a young guy and you hear old people talk about, oh yeah, you know, such and such a year, it seems like it was yesterday, and you're thinking, no, that was 100 years ago, dude, you're old. And now I'm doing it, man. Like, it does not seem that long ago the first time I met you.
I know. It was 1991, and we kind of talked about this a little bit about this last night, but let's just go through it again. So it was 1991, and I had been in the business for a year, and Lance had been in the business for a year, Lance Storm, and somehow he got the gig training at Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp. But the thing was, he was actually pretty good at it even then, after 1 year in the business. So you show up to go to wrestling school, and what were you promised as far as the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling School? Like, what did you think it was going
to be? Of course, you know, probably what you probably thought too is like the Hart Brothers is the royal family of wrestling in Canada. So I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a spectacular facility and there's going to be top notch training and elite level trainers there and stuff. And then I show up and I get off the bus and I'll never forget this moment in my entire life. I traveled 2,000 miles, uprooted my life to go to wrestling school. I get off the bus, I look up, and I'm looking at the Silver Dollar Action Center with a giant bowling pin on a pillar outside.
And what color was it?
It was pink.
Yeah, the pink bowling alley, which is where we trained.
But, you know, you and Lance were, for me, what you were for Chris, for Lance, the year before, because I got there and, you know, I walk in, there's a ring and I'm looking at all the other students and nobody even looks like they work out. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, what have I done? I've made this huge, stupid mistake. And then Ed Langley, who was running the school, brings you and Lance in and you guys looked like wrestlers. And then you ran a couple spots in the ring and you were really good even back then and inside your first year. So that, at least Lance always said, like, seeing you at least put his mind to ease that at least there's one guy here who looks like he's serious about it. And you and Lance were the same thing when you walked in, that I kind of breathed a little sigh of relief that, okay, these guys look like professionals even in their first year.
Did you know, like, that you were going to be trained by a guy who's in the business for 1 year? And did that even matter? Like, now you think about it, like, if someone shows up to a wrestling school, I'm training for wrestling, who's training you? Some no-name guy that's been in business for a year, you'd be like, dude, that's not good. Did you even think of that, or did you even... Do you even know about that back in those days?
No, I had only just found out that schools for pro wrestling existed.
You came from Ontario, right?
I did, yeah. Kitchener, Ontario. And that's another moment I'll always remember, is looking in the back of Pro Wrestling Illustrated and seeing the ad for Hart Brothers. Like, oh my God, you can get into this business. And so when I went there, I had no idea what to expect. So I had zero expectations in my head. And I didn't even stop and think to ask how long you guys had been in the business. Because like I said, you looked like wrestlers. And when you got in the ring and ran some spots,
some
like,
stuff, yeah. Yeah. Did you think there was going to be actual Hart Brothers there to train you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I thought Brett was going to be there. Yeah, and Owen was going to be coming through and stuff. And I saw Keith for like 2 days until he was sure that all the checks cleared. And then he was in the wind.
And that's exactly the same with mine. He showed up the first day, collected the money, stretched me, and then I never really saw him again the whole rest of the time.
Which is your first education in the world of professional wrestling.
Yeah. So when you showed up, like, I remember, like you just said, I got there and it was Lance was the only guy who looked like a wrestler. There's a bunch of fat kids and weird kids, and there's a kid who couldn't see straight, and there was what were some of the other people in your class?
Well, the guy I gravitated to almost right away was this guy, Joe from Ohio. I forget his last name, but a really big kid. He was kind of fat, but he was huge. And he had actually turned down a full ride scholarship to play football in university to come and be a professional wrestler. Like, dude, I wonder how many times he looks back on that decision now and regrets it.
Maybe he could get it back after that summer.
I'm hoping he did. He was a great guy, though, man. So we kind of hung out, and I actually ended up having my first match against him.
Joey Conquest,
who I believe that you put that handle on him.
And you were Powerhouse Paul Laser.
Yeah, I was really hoping that wasn't going to come up, and I still owe you a receipt for giving me that name.
Name. You like it?
Look, it actually is pretty awesome being able to say I had such a tragic name for my first match in the business.
He gave it to you by Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
Powerhouse Paul Laser.
And also the guy that I think is going to stick in your memory as much as mine, Calvin, who I don't think took a single shower or changed his clothes through the entire 8-week course.
Yeah.
That dude, like, every once in a while, he is the elastic in his pants was shot, so they would bag down. You'd see his underwear, and it would just get more and more stained and brown as the course went on.
That's the guy. I remember Lance looked at him and went, okay, you, have you ever seen the inside of a gym before? And his answer was, no.
But wouldn't that spark some self-awareness? Like, yeah, maybe I should start.
It's like that Silent Life skit where Shatner goes to John Lovitz, you, have you ever kissed a girl? No. And that's what Calvin was with the inside of a gym. And I always thought about that. Like, you know, if you go, sometimes you go to a strip club and you see like a couple girls there, God bless them, but they just do not look like strippers. And you're like, what are you seeing in the mirror when you get up in the morning? Are you seeing like, oh, I'm a stripper, I'm stripper material? Were these guys thinking, oh, I got like Calvin, like, once again, the most normal looking skid from Drum Hell or wherever the hell he was from, just looked like a bum that you'd see at the pool hall. No definition, no personality, no look. And he's signing up to be a wrestler. God bless you. You want to follow your dream, but like, are you not seeing the reality of the situation?
Well, you got to put the work in. I mean, I acknowledge your limitations and put the work in. Just having a dream isn't enough. And I think there's too much of that, like, even back then, but especially today, where people just think, okay, well, I want that, so I should automatically have it. Well, no. Mm-hmm. If you look like crap, I mean, let's be honest, Dusty Rhodes looked like crap, but
he could talk.
He could talk and could work, and he was amazing.
And he was still a big guy.
Yeah, he looked like he could fight.
Yeah,
like,
right.
He's a fat guy that was tough.
Right.
So you've got to have something like that. And then Calvin Copeland's case, you know, it's something that Cyrus on the Killing the Town podcast always talks about. You know, what's special about you if you look like you just walked out of the crowd?
Right.
So he was going to have to find something about himself, get in shape, and or, you know, learn psychology or learn to work. And he didn't do any of that stuff at all. So
how about Judge Jesse?
Oh my God, Judge Jesse, who's still working to this? Of all the guys who would still be working at this moment in time out of that class, you would never have picked Jesse. He looked like he hadn't even been through puberty yet.
I took my son years ago to see the movie Chicken Little, and I couldn't place it. And I was like, wait, he looks like Judge Jesse. Judge Jesse looked like Chicken Little. He's in glasses and stuff.
Oh my God.
But he had his gimmick. He was going to be Judge Jesse from day one. And this guy was about 135 pounds.
Yeah, he was 24 and looked 12. And actually, this is before Judge Jesse came on, because he's a legitimate lawyer now.
Oh.
So I think that's where the gimmick, but he was going to be Jazzy Jesse.
Oh, Jazzy
and
Jesse.
And he had his own tights. He showed up to school with these tights with Jazzy across the ass. And he had this I like the guy. I've spoken with him a little bit online since then, actually. Mm-hmm. And a really nice guy, but man, he had this really lame-looking double round kick. He'd kick you with his left leg, then his right leg, and it looked horrible. And there was one day that he was doing it to you, and you just had enough at this point. Like, I think you've been dropped on your head a few times, and some of the guys were being stupid. And he did the stupid little double kick, and you did it back to him, and it looked even lamer, and then you drop-kicked the hell out of him. He wasn't the only guy to get drop-kicked out of the ring by you.
Well, it was funny because Lance was the official trainer for the school. And I had nothing to do that summer and nowhere to go. So I just showed up. It was like Costanza in Seinfeld. I just kept showing up every day and just kind of weaseled my way into becoming a trainer until I finally asked Ed Langley, hey, man, can you pay me some money for this? And he paid me $400 for the summer. So that's 8 weeks. $400, so $50 a week I was getting paid to train you guys.
Man, that's even less than you get per match when you start.
And that's per week. That's 5 days a week. That's 15 hours of wrestling for $50.
Wow,
but,
man.
Yeah, so there you go. I just weaseled my way into training there. So when you started working, because we always laugh about all your gimmicks and all your names and all that sort of stuff, tell me some of the – were you Powerhouse Paul Lazor for a while? Did you ditch that right away? Because I remember you never liked it.
Yeah, I was Powerhouse Paul Lazor for like two or three matches, and then I got paired up with a guy named Eric Fries, who you'll remember because if I'm not mistaken, he was in Sudden Impact for like 2 seconds.
For when we went to Japan for the Dome.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so me and Fries were going to be Fire and Ice, so I changed my name to Rick Blaze, which ties in with Fire and Ice. Yeah,
get
see
it?
How clever I am? Man, I'm a genius. Yeah, so I was Rick Blaze for a little while. And then I really liked the comic book character Lobo. And I was always rolling around in my head how I might be able to incorporate some of that character in. So the germination of that just started with a name change. Nothing else. I didn't change, but I started calling myself Lobo Blackthorn, which totally does not suit me, did not suit me then.
And you know the thing is, you're not changing anything. You're still wearing...
No, I was still
exactly
Rick Blaze, but yeah. Now I'm Lobo Blackthorn. So yeah, that died a quick and horrible death. But
yeah.
I was able later on in my career to really roll it around in my head, and I started painting my face like that character, and I grew my hair out, and then kind of changed it and made it mine, and that became Death Wolf, which was my favorite gimmick of all time.
Was that just it was a Death Wolf Fenris?
It was initially Death Wolf Fenris.
Fenris,
which, yeah, the Fenris Wolf is from Norse mythology, and
okay.
he's supposed to come back, and that's the war the gods have where the world ends is against Fenris. So I love that, but then when I got to Detroit, which is where I really had the best time in that gimmick, it really got over huge, and they wanted
Wolf.
They just wanted
who
to call it Death
Wolf. Who was the promoter there?
That was Malcolm Monroe, the late Malcolm Monroe, and A.T. Huck, who is still running to this day. It was called Insane Championship Wrestling. Now it's called XICW, and they've been running for like 20 years or something, 17 years, 20 years, something, and great. It was so much fun. It was like an even lower rent ECW, but the same vibe. I mean, I remember the first match that I had for them, Sabu was in the crowd just hanging out watching, and it was in a condemned building, the Motor City Sports Club, so we could do all the property damage we wanted, and just an absolute blast. I loved it in that place.
So how far did you actually go in wrestling? Because I can't remember when you made the transition, because you went into MMA, and then now you're a stuntman, and there's a million things that you do, but how far did you stick with wrestling?
I was wrestling on and off until around 2001, I believe. I had my last match in 2004 in Portland Wrestling. Our mutual friend, Dr. Luther, brought me out.
Oh, cool.
But there was a big gap. You know,
I
wasn't wrestling regularly after 01. So I was kind of doing MMA and pro wrestling at the same time. And the MMA thing came about because of ICW, because of wrestling in Detroit, where I recognized a lady in the crowd, and then I realized I'd seen her on a UFC videotape. That was how far back we're going. This is 96. And her name was Phyllis Lee. And she
was,
she's a friend of the Malenkos and Sean Waltman.
Right.
And she was Dan Severn's manager for a while.
Okay, gotcha.
And so she had been managing him on UFC, and I thought, that's a good connection to make. So I went up and started talking to her, and I said, are you booking wrestlers? And she said, no, but I'm booking real fighters in a group called Pancrase. And I popped because I was maybe one of 20 guys in Canada who knew what Pancrase was, which was actually the elite MMA group in the world at the time, even over UFC. And like this crazy Japanese shoot fighting group where all the elite guys like Ken Shamrock and Boss Rutan and guys who would win the UFC title later came from Pancrase. So she said, are you a real fighter? In no way, shape, or form. I didn't even wrestle in high school. I didn't ever take martial arts or anything. I'm like, oh yeah, totally. I was a competitive strongman. That's
the Hollywood rule.
Yeah.
Can you skydive? Of course.
Yeah.
I better learn to skydive. Yeah.
So she gave me an application form and I filled it up with lies, all these garbage martial arts credentials that I didn't actually possess, sent it back to her, and it's pre-internet age, so I guess they didn't bother checking it. They just saw a picture.
Or couldn't.
Yeah, one or the other. Looking back, I think it was more a case of what they liked to do, because they ran Pancrase very much like a pro wrestling group. They even fought in a pro wrestling ring. And so their gimmick a lot of the time was to bring people in from all over the world, and the Japanese guys would slaughter them, and it would make the Japanese guys look better. So they saw this muscular Canadian kid. They'd never had a Canadian in Pancrase before. So they're like, okay, come on and fight. So my first fight of any type ever was in front of 10,000 people at Tokyo BNK Hall against number 3 ranked guy in the world.
Who was?
Ryushi Yanagizawa. He would later fight in K1 and rings and stuff.
How did you do?
Way better than they expected, way better than I expected. I got soundly dominated, but yeah. I fought way better than they thought.
Because I remember you were used to train by like taking like a stick and just whacking yourself in the shin like 1,000 times.
I'm surprised you guys even talked to me, man. I must have looked like a psycho.
You also did some stand-up too, and the best line ever was you came on stage with a bat and you pointed at some guy in the crowd and went, you better laugh.
Well, see, that's my anti-bomb insurance, because I know at least one dude's going to crack up at everything.
I think the other opening line you had was, I used to f*** guys like you in prison. It's like, here we go.
Dude, why did the comedy club people even talk to me?
Why are we talking
exactly
now? So you actually were a tough guy. Like you said, you're a power lifter, you're a powerhouse Paul Laser. But so did you take to the MMA pretty good, because you went over there quite a few times?
I guess they saw something in me, because I thought it was gonna be one and done. For me, it was a success that I didn't get killed, I didn't get slaughtered.
Right.
And I got to see Japan, because I was like, you guys were always going to Japan, and I was always so jealous. I wanted to see that country, so I got to see it. That was great. But like a week after I came back, Phyllis called me up and she's losing her mind. And she said, they want you to come back and live at their dojo for 6 weeks. So I guess they saw something where, looking back again, I see where even guys who were UFC veterans at the time, they would go to Pancrase. And it's kind of like you've said about WWE. You know, you can wrestle everywhere else in the world, but when you enter WWE, you realize, oh, this is the real deal. Yeah. This is the biggest of the big time. And that's what Pancrase was like, even compared to UFC at the time. So guys would go there and they would freeze up. And they would get murdered right away. And I didn't. You know, I just...
And it was a legit shoot.
Yes. Yeah. Which I wasn't even sure about, because there were a lot of rumors about, I'm sure you remember them, about how, you know, there were groups like Rings and UWFI that were running worked shoot, as we call it, where they looked real, like real fights, but they weren't. And people were saying Pancrase did that too, but they only did it very infrequently. So did UFC at the time. It was like maybe one fight in 30 was a work. Mm. So I'm the whole week before I fight, I'm waiting for somebody to come up and give me the finish. And nobody did. And I don't know anything. I didn't even bring a groin cup. I didn't bring a mouth guard. I didn't have a corner man. I didn't know anything. And I'm walking to the ring still thinking, did they forget to give me the finish? And then I got in the ring and looked down and there was just blood splatters all over the canvas. Like, okay, real fight. Here we go.
Right.
Yeah, so it was very much the real deal, and one of the most serious things I've ever done in my life.
But let's talk a little bit, just kind of incorporating both the things when you're talking about your wrestling career. Did you ever, like, how far did you get? Did you ever get a chance to maybe go to ECW or WWE or WCW or Japan or...
Not as a pro wrestler. Okay. I know that Dr. Luther almost got me booked in FMW as his tag team partner. They wanted another Dr. Luther clone, Dr. Hannibal.
Yeah.
And that ended up being Steve Gillespie.
I also auditioned for that part.
Oh, damn.
What a slut. He was auditioning everybody.
Well, I think it was Fred Jung was knocking him down as fast as he could set him up, because he was mad at you for something. He was mad at me.
Right, he was making
the call. So it ended up being Steve. But I did get to go to South Africa, thanks to Cyrus. He, I guess, Jim Peterson, the kickboxing maniac, he just completely disappeared, because he was a good guy, but insane. And he just went off the res and just disappeared.
I remember one time he wanted a gig, And so he went and got a razor blade, like a Bic razor blade, like a disposable razor. And he just, he broke the top off and just gigged himself with the actual like shaving razor.
Yeah, that sounds like Jim.
Yeah.
And 290 pounds, pretty solid. Yeah. That's a scary combination.
6'6", whatever the hell he was, yeah.
But he bailed on the South Africa tour, so Cyrus called me up and said, you want to go? And so I got to go and wrestle Gamma Singh at Westridge Stadium, again, in front of 10,000 people that wanted to kill me. completely crapped the bed in that match, but I got to go, and I got to wrestle in England for Brian Dixon for one match.
Okay.
And,
can you do a Brian Dixon imitation?
Not really, yeah, man. I'm not very good at it.
I can't remember. He's got a certain way of talking. I can't remember. Robbie Brookside does a great Brian Dixon.
I've heard his, and I don't even want to touch it because it's been done perfect. But yeah, you know, I got to see a little bit of the world, and better than I deserved, quite frankly, because I was always mediocre at best. But,
what about MMA? If you were going to Pancras, did you ever branch out and do more? Or did you realize it was just a short-term thing for you?
I developed quickly physically, and the Japanese guys saw that, which is why they let me stay at their dojo and train with them and, you know, get tied in knots by Minoru Suzuki every day. But I didn't develop mentally as quickly. Like, I know there are fights that I look back on, and I was just walking to the ring already mentally defeated, where I should have had a chance to win that fight, and I didn't.
And that's so much a part of it, is you have to be mentally positive and...
Absolutely, it's huge. I mean, it's like if you're doing a WrestleMania match, if you're thinking, oh, this match is going to suck before you walk out there, well, yeah, it's going to suck. Whereas, you know, even if you've got a horrible opponent who's completely green, if you go out there thinking, I'm going to polish this turd as much as I can, I'm going to make this great, then you got a very good chance of making it great. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a long time to learn that, but I did. I fought four times in Japan. Then Guy Mesger, who helped me out a ton before, like while I was in Japan, that guy really took me under his wing and helped me because I was freaking... He started a group called World Pancration Council in Texas, and he ran the first ever sanctioned MMA shows in Texas history. Mm. And I fought him on the first one. I fought Alex Andrade on the second one. And then my last MMA fight was my last fight of all, because I moved into Muay Thai after that in British Columbia. And then in 2005, I had my last MMA fight and finally got a win on my MMA record.
So what's your record? 1-6.
Hey,
you got one.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
I won 8 or 7 Muay Thai matches in between, though. Yeah, okay, so at least I won something. But yeah, it took me a while to get used to MMA.
But that's the thing. Like, you've had a real kind of a varied life, a lot of cool stuff you've done. Talk about wrestling, talk about the MMA. And we're going to talk about your books that you wrote when we were bouncers, because obviously you were a bouncer as well. But I just happened to glance at the back of the second one, because there's two books here. Paul the Mahler Lazenby is a former bouncer, MMA champion, pro wrestler, current actor, stuntman, whose career highlights include having his nose broken by Steve Austin, teaching Vin Diesel how to take a suplex, farting on Noah Wyle by accident, and farting on Steven Seagal on purpose. I want you to explain all four of those stories. Okay, so having your nose broken by Steve Austin, because you're Steve's stunt double in quite a few projects.
Yeah, I doubled him on 6 movies. He signed a multi-picture deal, and they shot all the stuff in Vancouver. So in the Vancouver stunt community, I'm the guy who's got the best skill set and look to double him.
Bald with a yet goatee.
It's weird. We've even got the same shaped skull. So like they were saying, they can shoot me in profile and it still looks like Steve, where they can't do that with a lot of doubles.
Right.
But yeah, one of his doubles on The Condemned was a Sam Greco, who's one of the best kickboxers ever.
I've heard that name,
But Sam's got this giant beak, like this huge nose. Like there's no way you're shooting him in profile, man. The first time I worked with Steve was on the movie Damage, his first time in Vancouver. And I was actually, there was another guy doubling him, and I was playing one of his opponents. So he, the whole day was fighting with this dude who was flinching away from him. And I'm sure you've seen a million times in the ring, where if a guy's flinchy, he's got to stay in the pocket when you're throwing punches and kicks and trust that you're not going to kill him. And if he's flinching, then it messes things up. So Steve got in the habit of kind of having to lunge forward a little bit to close enough distance that there wasn't air between the punch and the head. Then after all day of this, I'm in there. And he's got this habit that he's been forming all day, and I just stayed in the pocket. So went through the fight a couple of times, and then finally he just came about an inch too close and swung this big barn door left hand and took my nose and put it under my left eye.
Oh.
And I still remember it just went kunk, and I just thought it was a good solid shot to the head. And he kind of froze and looked at me, and I just went, dude, keep going, because I wanted to save the take.
Yeah.
And we finished the fight, and everything was good, and there was about a 5-second gap, and all of a sudden I felt my nose start to drip, and then boom.
Here it comes, yeah.
Yeah, and it was completely just one of the worst breaks I've ever had. Steve felt horrible, but I made sure he knew. It's just accidents happen. I've clipped guys in fights,
sure,
too.
Sure.
And afterward, when he finally found out I was okay and he was sure I was all right, the medics are working on me to stop the bleeding. And Steve comes over, and he's got his arm in a sling and an ice pack on his hand. And he goes, you guys want to stop messing around with Lazenby and help me with these bruised knuckles?
So what's the protocol on that? Like, does Steve send you a card, or is it just like shake hands and let's go to the next stunt? Like, is it cool when that happens? You know, does the star go out of his way to do anything, or is it just like, we're all good?
It depends on who the star is.
Gotcha.
You know, I've seen cases where actors did legitimate permanent damage to a stuntman and just walked away. Oof. And that's part of the job of a stuntman. You know, yeah. If that happens, well, that's an occupational hazard. In Steve's case, he was, you know, he called me the next day.
That's cool, yeah.
We went out for a beer that night.
Gotcha.
You know, we've become really good friends since then. But he was, you know, he must have apologized. I had to tell him, dude, you don't have to apologize
enough
anymore.
Yeah. Yeah,
it really is cool, man. Like, it's seriously, it's part of the job. And it's proof that if a guy like Steve Austin, who's done simulated combat his whole life and is really, really good at it, can clip somebody, anybody can. It happens.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen the same thing in the ring, man. It's like, no matter how good the performers are, every once in a while somebody's going to send one through.
I did a movie in Mexico in 93 with Roddy Piper. It was called Immortal Combat. And Art Barr took us down there, and because he was friends with Roddy from Portland. And so I'd never met Roddy Piper, obviously. He was like, oh my God, it's Roddy Piper. So once again, in fine Hart Brothers Jericho training fashion, I'm just hanging around. So they say, well, do you want to do some stunt work? Do you want to do a fight scene? And it was with this guy called Sonny Chiba, who's...
Oh, I forgot Sonny Chiba was in that.
Sonny Chiba. So it was my only stunt experience, and it started out where you do the fight scene, and the first... 5 or 6 takes, he is just like not even touching me. The kick is right up on my nose, and you just feel this. Take 8, 9, and 10. That dude was kicking me right in the face because he's starting to get tired, and he's like 60, and I'm like, oh my God. And of course, I'm like, this is gonna look great on camera. And you watch it, and I was in it for like a second. Literally, you have to pause it. And you see like my blonde wavy hair, and that was it. But that's what happens. Like, you can get clipped as the takes go on. That's just the way it goes.
And sometimes you have to do it on purpose. I mean, yeah. I was in Star Trek Beyond. There's a character called Hyder, which was played by a guy named Fraser Aitchison for 3 out of the 4 days. But he couldn't make the 4th day, so I stepped in. And I'm fighting Sophia Boutella, who I believe is a star of The Mummy now. And she was she was the legless assassin in Kingsman.
Uh-huh.
And she's a badass martial artist. She did all her own fighting and is really good at it. But because the costume was so restrictive and my vision was so impaired and everything, I couldn't really be sure that I was going to be in the right place for the kick and there would be too much air. So I had to lean into it. I had to tell her, like, look, you're just the spin kick. You're going to have to send it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, 8 takes. Just lean in and take this kick to the head. You got to do it on purpose.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
What's the most dangerous stunt that you've ever done?
I think it was the first time I doubled Steve, and I mean, I've done high work where, you know, if a cable snaps, you die, but generally
what does high work mean? Like, you're doing something
like 30, 40 stories off the ground.
Oh, like having a fight, like on a building or something? Or?
Yeah, gotcha. And I did what's called a descender, where you're on a cable, and they basically drop you at almost, well, a little bit past terminal velocity into a pool on a wire, but you're moving fast enough that if something goes wrong, you're going to die. But I think the most dangerous one was doing what's called an air ram. It's a compressed air catapult that you step on and it throws you. And to show you how powerful these things are, the first time I rode an air ram, I was 260 pounds, and that thing was easily throwing me 7 feet up and 30 feet forward.
Wow.
And it wasn't even dialed up all the way.
So that would be, for example, like if there's an explosion or something and the guy gets catapulted in the air or whatever, right?
And they're incredibly dangerous because if you ride them the wrong way, if your knee's not locked right, if your body weight isn't exactly where it needs to be, then you can destroy your leg, you can get thrown up in the air. People have even died going off air rams wrong.
Wow.
So I had to do a backwards air ram away from an exploding car that was in a driveway. The scene was that he drives up and his wife and daughter are trapped in an exploding car and he's trying to get them out and then the car blows up and he gets thrown up and back and onto the lawn of the adjacent house. So we're rehearsing this into high jump pads, which are really thick, and I almost broke my neck doing that. I landed wrong on one of the rehearsals and my body folded over and I heard my neck just go and I thought my neck was broken. Like, it was a relief that my hands and feet still worked. Had to rehearse it a few more times after that. And then on the day, all of a sudden, all these new variables come in. Like, as bad as the rehearsal was, now it starts to rain. So the lid of the air ram is going to be wet. So I got to be worried about my feet slipping off. I've got a buddy on the trigger. So if our timing isn't perfect, if I start launching my body too early, or if he hits the button too early or too late, then that's going to go bad. Then they're blasting flames in my face, so I have to have fire gel in my eyes shut. Then they say, oh, while you're in the air, can you turn your head away from camera so we don't see your face? These things get thrown in. And then they said, oh, yeah, by the way, we're seeing the lawn, so we can't give you pads anymore. So I got to land on my head on the lawn. Yeah. So and that was the gag, like up and back 6 feet or 6 feet off the ground, like 15 feet back and landing on my head and rolling through. So it was a real high pressure thing. But my buddy Chad Bellamy on the trigger did a perfect job and everything went well. So I just got some mild whiplash and it was all good.
But this is your job, is doing this. Like when you became a stuntman, is there like a course that you have to take, or like how do you get into the biz?
It depends on where you get in. I know in England, they're particularly strict. Yeah. You have to be certified in three or four different things on the on this long list of skills that they say you have to have. In Vancouver, it's quite the opposite. You can just walk into the business if you know the right people, which, you know, it's a good thing for guys like me because I came in with a skill set. You know, pro wrestling does translate if you modify some things, but there are some people that end up out of their depth pretty quickly. So it basically, you just have to build a skill set that warrants you coming in and also showing that you know enough to learn and have the right attitude that you can learn more. So we have an incredibly eclectic community in Vancouver where we got people who come out of, I know a guy who grew up in the favelas of Brazil and did capoeira his whole life. He's a stuntman. A guy who did wushu his whole life in China. He's a stuntman, you know, competitive trampoline artists and
everyone's got their own skill, their master that they're master.
And then you come in, you build on that. You learn how to drive. You learn, like, I learned to ride a horse and ride a motorcycle just because I was a stuntman. I needed it.
You have to, right. So, why were you teaching Vin Diesel how to take a suplex?
Oh, that was in The Chronicles of Riddick. And I was on the stunt team for that, the rehearsal to rap. It's the first show I worked on all the way through. And we were going over different fight scenes and stuff. And there is one scene where Vin is just carving his way through this bunch of what they call necromonger soldiers on this ash planet. And it's like a gauntlet of guys and he's just slaughtering them all. I got killed actually three times in that scene. I'll get killed and then run around behind the camera and then go back and get killed again.
Soldier number three, soldier number four,
And at the end, we were kind of spitballing in it and I said, look, you know, what about a suplex? Like, he's supposed to be a kind of a brutal guy. What about if he starts throwing people around? And they asked me what it meant, so I showed them a vertical suplex and we talked it over.
Like
and,
a pro wrestling
vertical. Just straight up pro wrestling
David
vertical
Smith.
Suplex. And they liked the idea of him taking it and reversing the suplex and throwing me onto a rock. So it actually made the movie, you know. His stunt double, he had two stunt doubles, Troy Robinson and Tim Connolly, and Tim ended up doing the actual suplex part, but Vin actually went up for it, and I went up and held him and then put him down, and we do the rest with Tim. And as you know, like a vertical suplex is kind of a dodgy thing to take for a lot
weird,
of people.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it taking it than people realize.
I'm not a fan of taking it, to be honest with you.
It's weird.
Yeah, I don't like it, yeah.
But, you know, he fully committed. You know, he trusted me and he got it right away. Like the first, I talked him through it. And then the first time we did it, he got it and he stalled it up there and stayed up as long as I wanted him there.
Okay, and then you pretended to fart. Oh, and you farted on Noah Weil by accident?
Yeah, that was on Falling Skies. And actually, that was right before I started doing DDP yoga, and that was actually the day where I was thinking I really have to do something, because my back had gotten so bad that every day I was on set I was thinking this might be my last day. And in that scene, I had to be tackled from behind by Noah Weil, and then we had a fight scene after that, like a 5 or 6 beat fight, and he was doing everything right. You know, he's coming in and tackling me the right way, but still, like, even though everything was all going right, my back was just killing me and stuff. So I don't know what I had eaten at catering, but that combined with the pain in my back, about 4 takes in, he came running in and all over him just as he tackled me from behind. And thank God there was like a 6 beat fight afterward to kind of fan the flames and stuff and just divert attention away from the horrible thing that just happened.
But you farted on Steven Seagal on purpose.
Yes. That was, again, I had food poisoning or something. I was really sick. And I had to come in and double somebody and I have to lead this by saying that personally, I've never had a bad experience with Steven Seagal trying to hurt me, but you're not going to find a lot of stuntmen that say that.
Really?
You will find a lot of stuntmen.
He's got a bad reputation, doesn't he?
Yeah. He does have a reputation for being rough with his stunt guys.
And meaning what? Like in a fight scene, he'll punch you for real?
Yes.
And why? No control?
That's a Steven Seagal question.
Gotcha. Or like a wrestler who's just stiff.
Yeah, I don't know if he's doing it on purpose, or I can't believe that he doesn't have the skill to control himself, because he actually is, like, his hand speed's very good and his hand-eye coordination is very good from doing Aikido for 50 years. But yeah, a lot of stunt guys have gotten hurt by Seagal, so I am not one of them, but a lot of them have. So we were doing a fight scene and He also likes to change things at the last second. So I'm doing the standard dumb movie bad guy thing where I'm 6 inches from his face holding a gun in his face instead of doing it from across the room. Yeah. And they got a 3-2-1 countdown. And then we've got this sequence that we're going to go through. And they're going 3-2-1. And they're just about to say go. And he goes, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. Just follow me. And then they go, action. So like, oh my God, there is no way in the world I'm going to let this guy do whatever he wants.
Because he's a legit like badass, right?
If you give him your arm, he will break it in 7 pieces.
Gotcha.
Yeah, he
can do that. Yeah.
He is very good with Aikido skills. And he's a huge guy. He's like 6'6 and over 300 pounds.
Mm.
So as soon as he touched me, I just launched myself into the log. He touched me again and launched myself over this furniture. And he loved it because it made him look good. But then at the end of the fight scene, he's got me bent over a table and he's kind of leaning up against me in the in an inappropriate position. And he's handcuffing my hands behind my back. And the camera's on us like from the waist up. And he starts doing this compliance move where he stands on the side of my ankle. And it's really painful. And it's something you do if somebody's fighting you a little bit and you give them something.
And no one can see it anyways.
Exactly. The camera's not seeing it. So at that point, like, I'm thinking, okay, I've been holding in this fart for the entire fight scene. And his leg is pressed right up against the crack of my ass. So I'm like, you know what? Screw it. If he's going to stand on my ankle, I'm going to let him have it. And I guarantee you he felt the heat. There was no noise because he was pressed up against me. I guarantee he felt the heat.
Oh, man. So let's talk about, I'm sure there's a million more stories you can tell me about Stuntman, but let's talk a little about your books, which is another cool thing. You've written both these books, two parts, When We Were Bouncers. How did you get the idea to do this?
It was just something I was rolling around in my head because I worked as a bouncer on and off for about 20 years. In fact, I believe I was either your or Lance's replacement at Malarkey's in Calgary when you guys quit. But I was thinking, like, bouncers have such crazy, insane stories, and yet I've never seen a book about bouncers that did well. And I was wondering why that was and trying to find a way to market these stories. And then I realized bouncers kind of have a negative association. It's kind of like, rightly or wrongly, a lot of people don't like cops for the same reason. Because usually when you deal with a cop, it's not a good situation for yourself. Whereas, you know, firefighters, everybody loves them. Because when you deal with a firefighter, usually it's a good thing for yourself. So bouncers are the guys that are beating you up or telling you you can't come in or whatever. And I realized I've been really lucky. I mean, I know people like you. I know people like UFC champion Boss Rutten. I know movie stars. I know a lot of famous people who used to be bouncers, and that's the connection for the reader, is even if you don't like bouncers, well, yeah, but I like Chris Jericho, I like Boss, I like you, Samoa Joe. And so that's the hook that's going to get people to listen to these stories. And once they read the stories, then I was pretty confident they'd be hooked from there.
So where did you start as far as getting some of these stories and some of these famous people to...
Initially, it was contacting people I already knew. I talked to you and Lance, and I talked to Boss Rutten. You were guys that I really wanted to get because you're high-profile guys. And then I started cold contacting people, and that's where I got really surprised. People who are extremely established in mixed martial arts, extremely established in the show business and wrestling, who I didn't know. But I would say, you know, Boss Rutten's involved in this, and that would kind of, I'd say Chris Jericho's involved in this, and that would get them to at least listen to me. And it shocked me that pretty much everybody, with only one exception, immediately jumped on board. They said, I love the idea, never heard of anything like it, I want to do it. And so I would get these stories from people that I had no idea I would get stories from.
Who said no?
Barry Darso, Demolition Smash. And he didn't say no, but I just sent him a request and I got a 2-word response. How much? and I don't have a budget for interviews. So I said, thank you very much. Yeah, your time is money. I understand. So
okay. That's not really how it works.
Yeah.
You don't get paid to do an interview. So tell me, like, is there some stories that you from your experiences
in
the books? Tell us some of your experiences.
I gave myself a chapter in When We Were Bouncers 1 just because this is a story that I haven't really heard anything like it from anybody else. And I think every bouncer's got one story like that. But it involved a buddy of mine named Johnny, who it's funny because, you know, your song Judas is just doing crazy really well right now. That could pretty much be Johnny's story. He was a really good guy, but he was so crazy that he eventually fell off and just destroyed his whole life because of his demons. But at the time the story took place, he was still kind of a solid guy and just insane. So a great guy to have around. White guy with dreads in like 92 when no white guys had dreads. About 230 pounds, just a big lump of muscle. And this guy had, his name was Vern Milano, had started a huge brawl. I was running security at a club called Revolution, which had a huge capacity. It was a converted roller rink. So if you had a fight, you could have 100 people involved in it.
Wow, so it's like a big roadhouse brawl.
And there was a really bad situation kicked off by Vern where it was me and Johnny against like 20 guys. And so we put Vern on the excrement list, so to speak. And Johnny told him, look, if you come back, I'm going to sodomize you. And yeah, and Vern started laughing, and he said, no, dude, I'm serious. I'm very, very serious. That is exactly what is going to happen if you come back to this bar ever again. So 6 weeks later, I guess Vern thought that things had blown over, and he came back, and Johnny dragged him out back, and I thought he was just going to beat him up because I forgot about the threat. You know, guys say stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
And he chokes Vern out, puts him down on the ground, and then he starts unbuckling his belt. Unbuckling Vern's belt and pulling his pants down. I'm like, oh, no. And this is in the lot outside behind the bar, so nobody's seeing this. I'm like, Johnny. And he pulls Vern's pants down and hikes him up so he's like cheek to the gravel and ass to the sky. And then he takes a condom out of his pocket and leaves it, unrolls it, leaves it on the ground beside Vern's face, steps around behind him, and like a field goal kicker, punts Vern right square in the anus as hard as he can. Still, Vern's still unconscious. And then he unzips his fly and takes his junk out and just lets it hang there and waits. And Vern wakes up, looks over, sees the condom when he wakes up, and then goes, oh, reaches back and holds his butt, and then looks over his shoulder, and there's Johnny zipping up his pants, winking at him and walking inside. He never saw never Vern in the bar
him.
Again.
Yeah, never told him yet. So tell me some of the stories that you liked from the two books.
What I like are the stories where, which is most of them, where I managed to preserve the voice of the bouncer, like Boss Rutan. I mean, if you ever heard that guy talk, he's a human cartoon character. Mm-hmm. He's so much fun to listen to. And I've had a lot of people say when I hear Boss's voice in my head when I'm reading the chapter, and I think he's the greatest bouncer of all time. Yeah, but I don't really want to translate his stories because the way he tells them is so crazy. Henzo Gracie, who kicks off the first book, I almost turned cartwheels when I got him on the phone because he's a Brazilian dude, and I love Brazilians. I got loads of Brazilian friends, but like those guys cannot keep a schedule at all. They're never on time. So I'm chasing Henzo forever. One of the nicest guys ever, by the way. And finally, he gets in touch. He goes, okay, dude, I got 15 minutes right now. I call him up. First words out of his mouth. When I was 14 years old, I was a bouncer in a whorehouse in the Amazon. Like, oh my God, this is going to be so awesome. So that's the first story of the first book, one of my favorites.
So what happened to him when he was 14 in the Amazon?
He was just him and his buddy, his 16-year-old buddy, saved up some money to go have a good time. And then some other customer didn't want to pay one of the ladies after he'd done his thing. So Henzo and his friend just tuned the guy up, like headbutted him, knocked the, because he had headbutted the in-house bouncer and knocked him out.
Yeah.
They jumped on him, and you know, Henzo, even at 14, had been grown up doing jiu-jitsu, so he choked the guy out cold, and they went, okay, you're hired. And so at 14 years old, he's living in a whorehouse, gets free services from the ladies. You know, he said
that was part of the benefits.
That was
now.
Part of the deal. He got free food and services of the ladies.
So who else, and so who are some of the other people that gave some good stories?
In book two, one of the chapters that stands out for me, there's a lot of them, but MVP, the former Intercontinental Champion, I believe tag team champion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still not sure exactly what his name is. I just call him M.
Yeah, Hassan Assad.
He's Hassan Assad, but yeah. He's also like Alvin. He's got all these different names.
That's right. He was Alvin something first.
Yeah. So it's Hassan Assad. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, right now it's Hassan.
Yeah.
But his chapter, just because every story he told me pretty much involved some other major celebrity. And it wasn't just that, oh, this person came out of the bar, had a drink and left. Like in-depth stories about Mike Tyson and DJ Khalid and Shannon Doherty and Kimbo Slice. The Kimbo one I really loved because I knew Kimbo.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going back and forth. Again, it was just his schedule so crazy. I was trying to get him for...
With M or with Kimbo?
With Kimbo.
I gotcha.
And I was trying to get Kimbo for book two, and I was talking to his manager, Icy Mike, and just the best guy. And then Kimbo died before mm-hmm. I could get his stories. So I wanted to commemorate him in the book. I've got a dedication to him at the beginning of the book. But then when MVP told me, oh, yeah, I worked with Kimbo. Here's a story about him. It was so great because he's such a good guy. I want to make sure he's remembered as much mm-hmm. as I can help.
Well, tell the Kimbo story.
Kimbo and... Okay, Kimbo and MVP don't look anything alike. They're both black guys, and that's where the similarity ends.
Different shades of black, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kimbo's really dark, mm-hmm. and M's a lighter skin. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the features are totally different, too. So at one point, M gets called to the front door, and there's a cop outside, and he goes, yeah, these two Hispanic gentlemen here say you punched one of them in the face. And now he's standing at the door just on the inside of the threshold. The other guys are on the outside of the threshold. So he's still in the bar. And he said he's wondering what's going on because he's never been outside the whole night. Like, I haven't even seen these two guys before. There's no way I punched one of these guys in the face. And at one point, he looks to his left, and this Kimbo, giant Kimbo, trying to hide behind a potted plant inside the doorway, and he leans out and goes, shh. And M's thinking, how could you confuse me for Kimbo? Come on, man. You couldn't pick us out of the lineup as being separate guys?
There's it's funny because when you're a bouncer, I remember, like, my job was, I used to have to walk through and have a little clicker and count how many people were in the bar. And I could never get it right. I would either come around with like 75 or I'd come around with like 450. And the actual count would be like, there's 200 people here. There's 250. I could never get it right. Cause all I wanted to do as a bouncer, all I did was sit in the back, listen to tunes and talk to girls. That was my thing. I never really wanted to get into a fight unless there had to be one.
You were smarter than most of us then.
Yeah, I was there for the chicks. That's why I got into bouncing. You know.
Well, that's what amazed me is that they didn't get it. It doesn't amaze me that was a job that was you couldn't focus on. It's that, like, anybody who knew you for more than a couple of days would realize, okay, Jericho's going to have the clicker, then he's going to see a hot girl or a song he likes is going to come on, and we're going to lose him.
Yeah, I literally just lose my train of thought. And it's like, you know, you go to this section. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh, there's a chick.
Yep.
Oh, shoot. Now I got to start over again. Did I count that guy already? Do I count this guy? What do I do? You know, and then another thing that I did as well, because I was really, as I am still, obsessed with Kiss. And Kiss Alive, Paul Stanley talks about the intro for Cold Gin. He talks about, you know, I had some vodka and orange juice. So I always wanted to have vodka and orange juice when I was old enough to start drinking, or when I started drinking when I was like 14, like vodka and orange juice, because Paul Stanley made it sound so cool. So I would go to the bar and that would be what I would drink during the night. He'd give me a Paul Stanley, I'd say to the bartender, and everyone in the place knew what a Paul Stanley was, vodka and orange juice. And then a Gene Simmons was a rum and coke. Gin and tonic was an Ace Frehley, and then there wasn't a Peter Criss because no one cares about him.
So. There's one thing you haven't mentioned since reading the book that I wonder if you noticed, is that right before I sent the final edit off to the formatter to get done, an idea hit me. So all the subtitles of stories in your chapter are the titles of Kiss.
I caught that. That's great.
Cool.
Yeah,
okay. I
was just looking at Cold Gin, and you wanted the best. I thought that was really, really cool.
Because they all had different titles, and then just the last second, I'm like, I have never met anybody who's into Kiss as much as Chris, and they got so many songs out there that there must be appropriate.
Good. So you didn't do that for all the stories, just for my chapter?
No, that was just for your chapter alone.
Gotcha. So who's the biggest names that you have in this book? You talk about Baz Rutan, you talk about MVP, you talk about Jericho.
Yeah, Theo Rossi from Sons of Anarchy and Luke Cage.
What was his story?
Oh, man, he had this big crew of guys that I think he comes from New York.
Mm-hmm.
So when you move to L.A., anybody who makes that move will tell you, you've been in both places, there's a very big difference in the way people think.
Yeah.
East Coast to West Coast. And the East Coast people, they're more inclined to just go straight to violence.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he rolled in with a big crew of guys, including his best friend Mona, who's like 350 pounds at 6'1", just a monster. And they basically annihilated the first bar they were at. And everybody was in shock. He said the worst thing wasn't the damage they did to the people who deserved it. It was the reaction. It was like, what? Just, I acted like an asshole all night, but why are you punching me in the face? Because that's the way we do it where we come from, man. But I like Theo's chapter. It's different because he gets very, very cerebral, mm-hmm. very philosophical. And he goes into a lot of the reasons for violence and a lot of the causes of violence. You know, being in that situation, going from East Coast to West Coast, made him analyze everything. And so you really get his perspective on why people behave the way they behave and mm-hmm. the differences between the way it's dealt with.
And I saw that Steve Austin did the foreward for the first book, maybe the second
book. Yes.
Was he ever a bouncer? Was Steve? Is he
you know what? That broke my heart. I thought for sure Steve would have been a bouncer, man. And he says he never bounced because he bounced, I think, one night his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I initially went from like the greatest emotional high to the greatest emotional low in 1 second because he goes, oh, yeah, I bounced one night at a Slayer concert. I thought, oh, something happened at a Slayer concert. He goes, yeah, nothing happened.
At the end.
What? Everybody came in, threw up devil horns, and went home. Oh, my God, this is heartbreaking. And that's why he would have been in book one, but I was asking him about writing the foreword. And again, being a busy guy and everything, it never came together. But when I sent him the first book, you know, he called me right away and said, dude, I don't read books front to back. I barely read books at all. It's just not my thing. He said, I plowed through this one in one sitting. I want to write the foreword for the second one, which was
that's great
music to my ears, man. I really appreciate him doing it.
And I see CM Punk on the back here.
Yeah.
How do you know Punk? Or do you?
I do. Yeah, we talk a lot online, and I flew out to Cleveland to watch his UFC fight.
Oh,
yeah, he's a really good guy. We just started I think just because we got a lot of mutual friends, we started talking on Twitter and then started following each other and just struck up a friendship that way. And yeah, he took it upon himself to, I asked him if he wanted a copy of the book, he read it and he took it upon himself to really pump it up. And he's been supportive of volume two as well. You know, and he's an honest guy too. I like bouncing my ideas off people that aren't going to spare my feelings. Mm-hmm, you know, and he strikes me as one of those guys. You definitely are. Where if it sucks, you're going to go, dude, that sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, fix it this way. And so you know, hearing good feedback from a guy like that, you know, encourages me that I'm onto something.
How did you get these published? Are they self-published or Punch in a Face Publications?
Punch in a Face Publications. That's my own.
You better laugh. Publications.
Yeah, I'm glad we live in the internet age because it's made things a lot easier. I was talking to Sam Sheridan, a really good friend of mine who wrote three best-selling books. He's also a fighter. His wife just directed Wonder Woman, actually, Patty Jenkins. So there's a lot of talent in that family. And Sam is definitely one of those guys where he has looked me right in the face and go, dude, that idea just sucks ass. It's horrible. And he told me the publishing industry is 2 to 3 years behind the times at all times. So when you're trying to pitch these ideas, you're usually pitching them to publishing executives or literary agents who don't really have their finger on the pulse at all. And I had people look at when we were bouncers and go, I don't really see any money in the idea. But it was only those people, like literary agents, anybody who was actually creative loved it right off the bat. So then I found out about CreateSpace, which is owned by Amazon. And you can basically publish yourself. They'll print individual copies for you. You don't have to buy giant piles of books.
Per order sort of thing?
Yeah. And I got a really good formatter for my ebook and a really good formatter for the print copy. And then it's distributed through Amazon and it's linked to all the major distribution networks. So basically any bookstore that can access James Patterson or can access Stephen King can also access my book if somebody wants it ordered in. Or you can order it straight off Amazon as well.
Have you had some good response? Have people been buying the books?
It's been great. I did a lot of research on self-published books, and it's not encouraging. I mean, most self-published books die within the first couple of months. And sales, I believe when we were bouncers, one has been out for a little over a year and a half, and sales have been consistent. And actually, they've gone up since two came out. And two has been doing really well as well. So
yeah, well, they're great books, and obviously you can pick that up on Amazon. We'll talk about that afterwards, where you can actually get them. But it's a really cool concept, and it's fun because it's like you said, 30 or 40 different guys in each book, all telling their stories. Some that you know, some that you don't, but they're all fun, you know, experiences of being on the front lines of the bar biz. But something that you said, you mentioned that you flew to Punk's fight in Cleveland. You fly around quite a bit to go to different shows. I remember, I think we almost saw you in Toronto because you were there to see the NXT show. You flew to Japan to see some shows there earlier this year. You'd like to do that.
I always wanted to do that, and I was always too broke to do it. You know, I think it's because when I was a kid, one of the things my parents did very right is take us all over the world. You know, I was in Africa when I was 11.
Wow.
I was in England when I was 12 and 13. And so I got wanderlust. I'm sure you obviously have it too, because you picked three or four different professions that all take you all over the world. And it's a great thing to do. So I always wanted to be able to do that. I'd hear about, you know, you're doing something in New York, or like there's a wrestling show in Japan or something, and I want to see it, but I never had the money. And I'm finally in a good situation in my career where I can just say, yeah, I want to go see Wrestle Kingdom at the Tokyo Dome and go. You know, I want to, you know, come down to Seattle and see a Fozzy concert. I can go. You know, it's my schedule is such that it's so erratic that I have a lot of free time, and it pays well enough I can do it. So I love it.
And you're a big NXT fan?
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Why is that? What do you like about it?
I think it brought wrestling back to wrestling under the WWE umbrella. I think it was, I don't have insider knowledge, but it's my impression that this was very much Triple H's idea. And I think it was a very, very good one. It's a wrestling show, and it's very wrestling heavy. And you know, there's something to be said for the storyline aspect and, you know, what SmackDown does and what Raw does. But I connect more with old school. You know, most of the show is wrestling. And also, you don't see your big names every week, so you get a chance to get hungry for them next week. I think what William Regal and Triple H and everybody who's involved in NXT is doing is fantastic. I just love the product.
That's great, yeah, because you do fly around a bit. What about the Japan, the Wrestle Kingdom? How is that going there? Because that was the Tokyo Dome show?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. To be honest, I don't want to sound like a douche by saying this, but to be honest, it is kind of tough to sit in the crowd when you're used to being backstage or being in the VIP section. So it was tough, and it says a lot for how dedicated the fans were, because that was like a 5.5-hour show. So it's pretty grueling, but oh my God. I mean, that was the show that had the first Kenny Omega-Kazuchika Okada match, the six-star match. as a main event, and there was some really, really amazing talent on that show. And it was just so great to be back in Japan. I mean, when I went to fight, I grew to really love it very quickly. I loved that country. But again, you know, after I stopped going, nobody was paying my way over there anymore, and I had no money. Mm-hmm. So being able to afford to fly over there and, you know, stay at a nice hotel and see Tokyo again, it was I loved every part of that trip. And yeah, definitely seeing that, and then going to the Korakuen show the next night, because there's traditionally January 4th is the Tokyo Dome show. That's like New Japan's version of WrestleMania. And the night after, they have a show called New Year's Dash mm-hmm. every year. And that's kind of more a comedy show and multi-man tags. And Kyle O'Reilly invited me to go there because he was wrestling on the show. And just walking into Korakuen again, because that's where I had my last fight in Japan, just blew me away. It's like I had this huge, like, physical sensation of nostalgia when I walked in. Like, wow, man, 20 years ago, I fought here. Yeah, this is crazy.
Dude, I haven't been to Korakuen in 20 years. That was like the original old school texting. I'd write a message for Lenny on the wall. He'd write a message, you know, the next month. I'd go back and then write another message. But yeah, I hadn't been there in a long time either. That's a cool, famous building there, you know?
That's another thing that tripped me out about Japan too, is being connected to home. Because you remember from being in Japan in the 90s, when you were gone, you were gone.
Yeah.
Like, that's, people didn't see you. Your friends didn't see you.
You had to buy phone cards to call internationally. Yeah. Those little phone gimmick things.
Work out what the time zone was. And now it's like somebody can text me just the same as they can right now.
Right.
That was kind
of
weird.
Online, all that sort of stuff too. Last couple questions, going back to your wrestling, what was your favorite match that you ever had?
Easy. Hands down, it was against Dr. Luther in Durban, South Africa. A 2 out of 3 falls match at the Westridge Stadium. And he gets 99% of the credit for that. You know, that I at least had gotten to the point in that tour where I'd kind of knocked the rust off. I was really rusty at the beginning. And I botched a couple spots, but for the most part, I would still kind of crap myself at the concept of a long match. And we went 45 minutes and it felt like 10. And yeah, he put together such a great match. And at the end of it all, it was funny because we had these girls that we were hanging out with while we were there, and people who had kind of attached themselves to us that were hanging out with us and knew we were friends. And afterward, they were all coming up to us and going, dude, are you guys okay with each other? Like, they thought we were really hot good? And we hadn't really been trying to kill each other. So yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Luther, because that easily best match of my career.
And what's your favorite stunt you've ever done?
That's a tough one, man. Farting on Seagal has to be up there. That's definitely on the list. I would probably say one of two. It would either be the air ram I was talking about before, just because it was such high pressure and so difficult, or the 20 floor descender. It was the pilot of a TV series called Agent X. Stars a great guy named James Heppner and Sharon Stone. And I got thrown off the top of a 20-story building. And it was a sphincter opener for sure. You know, we had to do a lot of work at the top of just showing me going over the edge repeatedly. And just the idea that I'm hanging from a crane that's on the other side of a busy street. You know, the crane's going over the street and holding me up. And if one thing goes wrong, you know, it's not just whoops. It's 20 floors about it. And then splat. So it was a really tough gag and one that I'm particularly proud of.
Do stuntmen, like, does that happen, accidents? Have you been on set when a stuntman passed away? Or?
Yeah, right before I got in the business, a gentleman named Mark Akerstrom died on set.
Oof.
And it was just the craziest thing. They blew up a boat like a quarter of a mile away, and there was a car battery sitting on the boat that they didn't know about. And so the boat blew up, and they're all looking at the monitor a quarter mile away, and everything, okay, yeah, that went well. And all of a sudden, boom, Mark's on the ground. And it's just, this thing had flown that distance and hit him in the head. So stuff like that happens on set all the time. I mean, I got permanent eye damage and permanent vision damage my very first, not just the first day of my career, the first take, the first time the cameras were ever rolling on me as a stuntman, I got the whole side of my face caved in and permanent vision damage. So
from what?
It was an actor who was training with Bossaroot and the UFC champion, and he got very excited during the fight scene. And I think sometimes when you're training real fighting, you know, and Bossaroot can show you how to really mess people up, sometimes it's easy to forget that there's a way to simulated punch somebody and a way to really punch someone. And so with the choreography, I was throwing my head one way and he was sending a punch in with every ounce of his strength the other way. And I basically doubled the power of the punch with the way I was throwing my head, and it just completely shattered the whole side of my face.
Oh, man. So that's part, like you said, that's the danger.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I fought 2 world champions in mixed martial arts, and you know, I got a torn bicep out of one of the fights, but otherwise not too bad. And then, you know, just having a fake fight with a guy that's not really a fighter, and I get the whole side of my head cracked.
You mentioned Vin Diesel and Seagal. Are those the biggest guys you've done work with, or is there a bigger star that you've been working with?
There's been quite a few. Will Smith, I worked with him on iRobot.
Nice.
Really nice guy. One thing on the Chronicles of Riddick really tripped me out was one day I showed up and I got my coffee and I'm just walking through the set. And I realized before I finished that coffee, I had said hello to Keith David, who's, I love that guy as an actor.
How did the Franks get above the beans?
I had said hello to him. I had said hello to Vin Diesel and I had said hello to Dame Judi Dench. I'm like, this is the best job ever.
And last question, tell us about the time then you got sodomized by a sea monster.
Dude, will you let that go?
Okay,
thank you for the platform because I want the truth to get out there, man. This is all the fault of a guy named Alex Ponovic.
Yeah, Big Al, used to be a bass player in a band called Specula Black, I believe, in Winnipeg.
That's right, Winnipeg native. Yeah, and this is the actual story. It's from an...
Because you did get screwed up the ass by a leg monster.
I did not get screwed up the ass by a leg monster.
Okay. Here we go.
All right, here we go. This is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. And I hope this doesn't get edited off the show because I know you have control of that. It was an epic movie that I think the Academy really should have considered for a Best Picture Oscar called Kraken Tentacles of the Deep. From the title, you just know. Was it
a sci-fi channel?
Yes, sci-fi
channel. Yeah, of course.
So me and Alex are playing these thugs on this particular gem. And we both got to get killed by a giant squid. So my scene, in spite of what you will have people believe, involves me falling off the side of a boat and then getting dragged under the water and eaten. Just torn to pieces and eaten. Nothing sexual. Alex's death was supposed to involve him having the tentacle rammed up his ass and come out of his mouth. And he vetoed that at the last second.
How does he have the power to veto that?
Sometimes you do. It depends on the size of the project and also your caliber, like where you are in the pecking order. But I guess he was high up enough, the call sheet, and it was
high enough to veto the sodomizing by the lake monster.
Yeah, one or two notches down the call sheet, he might have been having to take it up the hoop.
So, but then because he vetoed it, then you had to do it, right?
I did not do it. Nobody got sodomized by the lake monster.
Is that the worst thing you've ever done? Is that the worst project you've been a part of?
No, that would probably go to a movie called Killer Punjabi, which had a one-night theatrical run. It was self-financed by this Indian dude that just couldn't act, what we were talking about before. He's one of those guys where it's like, I want to be a movie star, but I'm going to do nothing to find out or build my skills or anything. So he financed this movie with his own money, and it was just horrible. Like, the guy was... I think he might have actually been mentally challenged a little bit because he was so awkward. Yeah. He could barely get his lines out. I remember at times during fights, I would grab him by the shoulders and turn him a certain way and go, stand, look over there, stand. I'd be yelling at him. My buddy Jason Day, he's a UFC veteran and now a stuntman. And my final death scene where the hero kills me off, he takes me out and then I walk over to Jason and I go, how did that look? He goes, basically it looked like he was touching you and then you were throwing yourself all over the place. But yeah, that was...
Killer Punjabi
was probably the worst movie I ever...
We can see that somewhere.
It's got to be out there somewhere.
Yeah. Dude, great talking to you. Powerhouse Paul Lazor, who did or maybe didn't get sodomized by a lake monster.
Thank you.
All right, thanks to Paul Lazenby. You can get both of his books, When We Were Bouncers, Famous Actors, Athletes, and Others Tell Insane Stories of Their Days Behind the Velvet Rope, and When We Were Bouncers, Volume 2 at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy books. Paul's got great stories from Edge, Lance Storm, Baz Rutten, Samoa Joe, Gene LaBelle, Steve Austin, and many, many more. And I'm sure Paul's going to tell a lot more of those stories on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea when he comes aboard, as he does a live Killing the Town podcast with Cyrus on the ship. You can be there. You can say hi, meet Paul, meet Cyrus, meet everybody. Meet Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Raven, Rey Mysterio, Ricky the Dragon, Steamboat, live podcasts with Killing the Town. Keep It at 100 will be live. Beyond the Darkness will be live. Unprofessional Wrestling Podcast. Busted Open Radio is going to be there. How about some live comedy? Brad Williams, Craig Gass, Ron Funches, Sal and Q from the Impractical Jokers. How about karaoke with Pat Patterson? Maybe Marty Scurll will join him. How about some great rock and roll? Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour, Phil Campbell, the Bastard Sons, Fozzy, King, The Stir, Dave Spivak Project, The Cherry Bomb, Shoot to Thrill, Blizzard of Ozzy, and of course the Ring of Honor, Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches taking place in the middle of the sea, and the winner of the tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shop in the future. Kenny Omega will be there, Young Bucks, Marty Scurll, Briscoes, Dalton Castle, Jay Lethal, Cheeseburger, Dion, Brandy Rhodes, Melissa Santos, Mandy Leon, Kelly Klein, Matt Taven, Flip Gordon, The Dogs, Brian Cage, Cody's going to be there, Delirious,
All the people are going to be aboard. Go to chrisjerichocruise.com and find out a way to book your cabin. Be a part of history. Don't miss out on the very first Chris Jericho's Rock and Rusty Rager at Sea. Go to chrisjericho.com and book your cabin now. All right, coming up on Friday, he is hilarious. He is a legendary actor, comedian. Talk about Chris Tucker. Chris Tucker's Friday Rush Hour. What's it like working with Jackie Chan? What was it like hanging with Michael Jackson? Making the Friday movies with Ice Cube? How he ended up with Tarantino's Jackie Brown? Chris Tucker's going to be here. Chris Tucker's Friday Rush Hour. That's the name of the show. See what I did there? Good stuff. Bringing in only the A-listers here on Talk is Jericho. We'll see you on Friday with Chris Tucker. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.